Welcome to the Divorce Podcast, where we explore all aspects of ending relationships, separation, and parenting apart. If your marriage or partnership has ended, or you have friends and family who are separating, this podcast is for you. I'm Kate Daly, a relationship counsellor, divorce specialist, and co-founder of Amicable, the online legal service for separating couples. In each episode, we look at relationships and separation from different angles, including the emotional, legal, and social. I'm joined by experts and special guests who share their own unique stories, experience, and tips with the goal of helping people end relationships in a kinder and better way. In this episode, I was joined by Nav Mirza to talk about his experience of divorce, what happens when the system fails, and why he founded Dads Unlimited. Dads Unlimited is a men's mental health charity working with fathers who've gone through family separation and male victims of domestic abuse. Its purpose is to help improve the outcomes for the men and the people they care for. Nav wanted to make life easier for dads in his situation and provide the advice, support, and community he didn't have. I want to let you know that Nav talks about topics that some listeners might find distressing, including poor mental health, abuse, and suicide. We've included in the show notes organizations who can help if you've been affected by any of these topics. We begin this episode by exploring Nav's experience of divorce and the various ways he and his family were let down by the legal system and other public bodies. We explore positive reforms that have taken place since Nav's separation, as well as future reforms that need to happen to help protect people in similar situations. Nav also explains more about the wonderful work of Dads Unlimited. If you loved this episode, then please subscribe and rate us on your preferred listening platform. Welcome, Nav.
Hi, Kate. Thank you very much for inviting me on. Real pleasure to meet you.
Oh, it's lovely to meet you. Thank you for sharing all of your experience and your story with us. It's really great to hear a different perspective and a different voice. Now, I'm going to talk a little bit, if we can, just about your own separation and the impact it had on your life. So sort of tell us the background and how you sort of became acquainted with this world.
I went through a divorce back in March 2013. And like with all these sort of things, kind of came out of the blue for me, actually. And it hurt a lot. It was around infidelity and I didn't see it coming. And yeah, it was quite shocking. And just had to sort of move on and attempted initially to reconcile, but when reconciliation wasn't on the table, you then move into the next phase, which is to divorces as best you can. Our son at the time was around, I think, 3.5, 4 years old. So it was important for me that he's looked after as much as possible and that whatever happens, the impact on him needed to be as little as possible. At least that's how I thought it would be. But these things never quite run to form, do they? So
no.
It started off okay and very quickly became quite acrimonious. And my ex-wife moved out of the house, took quite a lot of the possessions. Well, I quickly realized within hours of them leaving, actually, the house is empty. And I remember going to work, coming home, and then breaking down the very first day because there's silence. You just walk in and it's silent and there's nothing there. And I remember that really hurt. But obviously engaged solicitors and, you know, off you go down that road. But in that period, and forgive me, the timelines are a bit hazy, in that period of separation, because it started to descend into quite significant acrimony, my son that was coming to see me, and it was predominantly weekends because I was working on the weekdays, he started sort of making disclosures to me about things that were happening to him, which initially got me very worried, actually, very worried. I obviously made contact with my ex-partner and said, look, I'm not quite sure what's happening here, but this is some of the stuff he's saying. And of course, she would say, oh, this is all, no, she denied it and said, I don't know why he would say that. None of this is true. Mm-hmm. And I kind of left it on that, really. But my son was quite consistent with his disclosures and it just got worse and worse. And so I thought, well, I could approach my ex again and see what happens, but I'll just highlight to the school, just have a conversation with school with, you know, let him make these disclosures at school, because that would be a lot easier because they'd be with professionals and they may take it more seriously if they pick up on something.
Okay.
But the school didn't do anything. Didn't even acknowledge any of my letters or emails or any communication. So I went back to my ex again, stonewalled with, no, this is not true, this is not true. But then it just got worse and worse. And I remember on one handover, my ex's new partner tried to attack me in front of my son. And that's when I realized, oh, I think my son might be, you know, one, he might be right too. Oh, he's going into a place of, not danger, but he's at risk.
Well, violence, a place of violence, presumably.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I then contacted the police, social services, the school, et cetera, et cetera. And almost instantaneously, my ex-partner stopped me from seeing my son, which the police did warn me about and said, you know, this is quite common practice where, particularly where dads are raising alarm bells, they get stopped from seeing their kids straight away. And so I wasn't seeing my son. And you can imagine, I was extremely worried, extremely concerned, didn't know what was going to happen to him, knew he was in a place of where the potential of violence. And I started to really not concentrate at work. I had a very, very senior role in a public sector organization. And I could feel my mental health begin to suffer because I was every day worried and just concerned and scared. But no matter who I spoke to, who I wrote to, whatever local authority, et cetera, nobody communicated. So then obviously started the application for a child arraignment order. I'm going to fast forward a little bit. That took a 3 or 4 months. Finally got a shared care arrangement. And finally my son is back in my life again. And I thought, brilliant, you know, we're back. I could just draw a line over that. But he didn't stop making these disclosures.
So, just to clarify, you had a child arrangements order, but nobody had taken those concerns seriously. Nobody was investigating what was going on in your partner's home or anything like that at that point.
Absolutely nothing.
That's scary, isn't it? That allegations are made, disclosures are made by a child, and nobody does anything.
Exactly. But all too common, I'm afraid. So we got a shared care arrangement, but my son was still making these disclosures.
Yeah.
But he was also, I could also see some bruises on him.
Right.
And so I started taking photographs. I spoke to my solicitor and she said, right, we've got to raise this even higher now. So I did, contacted social services again, contacted the police, et cetera, et cetera. And then social services got involved. Police officer came to see me. They did a little bit of investigation, said, and I'll never forget this. They just said, there's nothing untoward going on here. There's nothing untoward going on here. Nothing at all. Nothing at all. Don't worry. We think you might be coaching. Please don't coach your son. If we think you're coaching, we will arrest you because this is perverting the course of justice, et cetera, et cetera. Again, I was really worried because I was speaking to my lawyer at the time thinking, well, this isn't how I thought this would be turning out. And then, again, my son was coming back to me. He just kept making disclosures. Mm-hmm. And I thought, I'm not going to talk about what those disclosures were, but they were alarming enough for me to be really worried. Mm-hmm. And so I just spoke to my solicitor. I said, look, he's still saying these things. We've been investigated. I don't know what's happening. And so we just said, we're going to have to raise the alarm again. So we did again. Social worker came back again. And I'll never forget this. I'll never forget what he said to me. He said, look, you better do what I tell you when I'm investigating. Otherwise, I'll make your life hell.
Wow.
And I thought, wow, what on earth is going on here? And then it was followed up with a police officer visit 2 days later with, you need to stop making these allegations because you are seriously under risk of being arrested and prosecuted for what you are doing. We've warned you that there's nothing going on. And yeah, it was just awful. It was absolutely awful. And that's when my mental health was at rock bottom. And that's when the first time I tried to take my own life that evening, because I just thought, I can't champion my son's voice. Sorry for getting emotional. I can't champion my son's voice. I can't get any statutory authority to listen to what I am saying. I can't get anyone to even have an inkling of curiosity or just concern to just look into this stuff properly. It felt I was being discriminated against. I felt like I was, because of being a man as well, that I just couldn't be believed, basically. And
silenced, like your son was being silenced, it sounds like.
Exactly. And so obviously I failed in that attempt and had to sort of pick myself up. By then I kind of lost my job because I had to resign. I tried to get a lot of flexibility and or understanding from my employer, but they were giving me absolutely nothing. In fact, I remember my boss even saying to me at the time, you know, I think you may have your priorities wrong, Nav, which I thought, wow, that's incredible. So I kind of lost my job. And then I kind of just descended, because when the police came back round again, etc., my ex-partner then stopped seeing my son again. And so then I went through a new period of not seeing him. And it was during this period that in Jan 2015, I remember I got a knock on the door. So bear in mind, this has been going on like 18 months. And it was, again, another police officer, social worker, with the usual gamut of nothing's going on, stop making stuff up, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And then again, that I remember that in January, I tried again to take my own life because I just couldn't, I couldn't get out. I couldn't get out of this situation. And I felt a failure because I couldn't protect my son. I just couldn't protect him. And it was just, yeah, it was just the worst time of my life. So I failed again. I hurt myself quite badly as well. And I remember my friends at the time, a couple of them were just like, yeah, you've got to keep going. Something will happen. And I spoke to my sister and she said, look, I'm really sorry, but it just sounds like, keep a journal, keep a diary, don't, let's not say and do anything anymore. And it just feels like the tide will turn if, you know, something will happen, something will happen. Mm-hmm. And then a few weeks later, I got a knock on the door again. And this time it was a lady who introduced herself as a new independent social worker. And I thought, oh my. And I did. By now, I was suffering with like probably moderate post-traumatic stress disorder.
Yeah.
Extremely high anxiety, low self-esteem. It was just awful. So every knock on the doorbell was just a trigger for panic, because I just thought, here we go again. And I missed out. I've missed out a lot. But I remember another episode was I had the police raid my house one day because my ex-partner had said that I had a shotgun in the house and I was going to go around and kill her. And I had all these police officers come around my house to search it, which they searched and said, oh, there's nothing here. I was like, I know. Mm-hmm. But it was constant, just, it felt harassment, to be honest, it felt like constant. Mm-hmm. But anyway, back to this independent social worker, she came in, and to be honest, for the first 30 seconds, I couldn't understand a word she was saying, because I was just in such panic. Mm-hmm. But luckily, my cousin was with me, and he said, look, you're going to have to repeat this all again, because he's not listening to you. Mm-hmm. And she said, look, I've reviewed your file, and we have had an incident at your ex-partner's house. Your son has been harmed. He has been harmed for the last 18 months, and you have been right. And we're sorry for everything you have gone through. I kind of collapsed on the floor there.
I can just imagine.
And she said, go to school now, pick him up, and he's never going to leave your side again. And that was Jan 2015. I think he'd just turned either five. Yeah, around five or six, sorry. That sort of age. And yeah, it just happened so fast. Just went to court. You know, non-mol orders were ordered, et cetera, et cetera. And transfer residence, everything. And then it was, then it was just me and him. You know, he had some trauma counselling. I had counselling. And we had a lot of support initially. There was an element of me which was, well, now the support's coming. 2 years ago, he would have been fine if this was put in place. And I remember attending lots of, you know, child protection meetings and all these child in need meetings, et cetera, et cetera. I remember saying to this meeting once, you know, it's great that you're all doing this, but you didn't do this 2 years ago and you didn't listen to me. So who protects the children from the people who are paid to protect the children? Because it's not you guys, it's me, and you didn't listen to me. But I was then given a choice. What do I do now? So I started this new single dad journey, doing the school runs, homework, you know, the real fun stuff, the bath time, the bedtimes, all the brilliant stuff. And at the same time, because he was suffering, you know, from the age of six to about eight, nine, just slept in my room. He couldn't sleep on his own, had to be in my room only. His trauma would manifest in ways which were a little bit challenging, but you know, we got through that. But I also realized I've got a new journey here. That I'm trying to look after myself, trying to look after my son. All my friends are at work. When you reach out online to look for support for men who have gone through family breakdown and dads who become single dads, a sole resident parent, there's nothing out there. Not saying I'm an intelligent man, but my grey matter was, you know, was drying up, because my only conversation all day was with a six-year-old. Because, you know, I said I couldn't go out at night because I had no childcare.
No.
I did try to get a job. I remember the job centre guy saying to me, I can't place you. You've got so much experience, so many qualifications, but you've also got a child protection order. You would have been school runs. We just don't know where to place you. I contacted childminder agencies and they said, sorry, we don't place anyone with a single dad. I then contacted au pair agencies. Sorry, we don't place anyone with a single dad. So I was just hitting barrier after barrier after barrier. So in March 2017, I set up a Facebook page called Dads Unlimited, and I thought, right, I'm just going to reach out. Can't be the only one here, and you know, maybe I can help others. One or two trickled through, then three and four, five and six. And I realized, I thought, okay, this is, and a very good friend of mine said to me, I think you've struck on something here. Let's see where this goes. Maybe you should turn this into a charity. And so that year, September 17, Dads Unlimited got registered as a charity. Got my first little bit of funding from our local Kent Police and Crime Commissioner. And I even have to pinch myself. In 6 years, we have gone from that little Facebook page to supporting over 2,500 men across England and Wales. I've got about 20 staff. We deliver family breakdown support services around child arrangements orders, around mentoring these men so they are looked after. We deliver mental health counseling to these men so they are not thinking suicide is an option. We deliver a co-parenting program. 2021, the Ministry of Justice commissioned us to set up the first male victims of domestic abuse agency. We run support group meetings, community activities. And like I said, the jewel in the crown for me was one of the things I wanted to do when my divorce and all that finished. I mean, I was left around £40,000-£50,000 of debt. Started working very closely with public health. We realized figures to suicide are family breakdown, loss of contact with children, self-harm, debt. All of these factors are in men who are going through family breakdown, yet nobody cares about this or even looks at divorce as a serious, divorce and separation as a serious issue. So one of the things I wanted to do was to revolutionize the way family law was delivered. I wanted to hold a mirror up to lawyers charging £200 an hour plus VAT to say, you could be contributing to this man's death because he will run out of money. Mm-hmm. He may end up homeless. He may not be able to see his children. Mm-hmm. And everything that makes him a father is stripped away from him. Mm-hmm. He will do what I did, which is he'll kill himself. And I wanted to hold up a mirror to local authorities and go, we've got to do better at this. There are kids being harmed. And men and fathers have an instinct as well that should be listened to. We know if something's wrong. So the charity has grown into such a thing. I mean, I still can't believe we're as big as we are. I am very lucky that in the 6 years, we have only lost one man to a completed act of suicide. But we have helped thousands of these guys and double that for the amount of children. Most guys are coming with two children. And we're getting this done. But the other thing is we run and we have succeeded in delivering professional legal representation to these men in court.
Right.
Through a barrister representation service, because I was very lucky that we were awarded a license access certificate, which means the charity can instruct barristers direct.
Yeah.
I've got, I don't know how many precisely barristers, but we've got about, I think it's about 75, 80 barristers working for Dads Unlimited who have agreed to sit on our fixed fee scheme. I can't, for commercial reasons, tell you the cost. If a father comes through us and is having difficulties in seeing their child, and say they go through the first hearing, second hearing, and a third final hearing, I think they're not spending that much money. Mm-hmm. It would be less than four figures.
Yep.
And that is a revolution. It's revolutionary to deliver that kind of level of support. And it then removes a trigger to suicide. Don't worry about debt. You're not going to pay that much. You'll pay something because you have to pay something, but we're also reducing litigants in person from the court, and therefore access to justice is improving through the work that we do. So much so that, you know, we got recognised by Sir Andrew McFarlane, actually, the president of the family courts, who I've met on quite a few occasions and given some keynote speeches with. There is a better way to do this, and we've got to do this better. We've got to improve outcomes of kids' parents. We've got to absolutely think harder around the mental health impact on parents and children going through family breakdown. We have to realise every parent going through family breakdown is a vulnerable adult, and we've got to say to some lawyers, you've got to reduce your fees. I mean, that's the fact of matter.
It's not just the fees, though, is it? The whole idea of getting lawyer pitted against lawyer is pitting parent against parent. The whole model is wrong. That's not how we should treat family matters. You can't have whoever's got the access to the best lawyer winning, because that lawyer can make an argument on a particular day of the week. It's got to be what's best for the child, what's best for the family. How do we keep those relationships, even if you're not together as, you know, husband and husband, husband and wife, wife and wife, whatever it is. If you're no longer together, you still are a co-parenting unit.
Yeah, and the thing
is, your kid still needs both of you.
Absolutely. And what we've succeeded in doing, I think, definitely regionally, and we've had more traction nationally, is to start to say to the sector, we've got to look at family separation with children as a public health issue and not something around the lines of, oh, well, this happens to a lot of people. Don't worry, you'll get over it. It'll be all right. Have a few days off, blah, blah, blah. It's much more pernicious than that. Because the ripple effect of parental conflict can go all the way from parents to children to cousins to brothers to sisters to uncles to aunties to grand. We've helped grandparents get SGOs to see their grandchildren because parental conflict is so evil.
Yeah, and it's also, it goes down the generations as well because it affects your kids and then it affects them as they grow up. It affects all of their relationships.
Exactly.
It just never stops. And I think that's the hardest thing. And I think you're right. It's a public health issue. It is not a justice issue. So when we talk about access to justice, it always makes my hackles rise a little bit because it's kind of like, is that the point? I think the point is it's about caring for people when families change.
It's compassion. It's compassion. And, you know, as I said, we've only been going 6 years, but last year we were lucky enough to win the GlaxoSmithKline King's Fund Impact Award for 2022 as one of the best charities in the country, which is not bad going for a six-year-old charity. You know,
you have some serious accolades under your belt, don't you? I mean, it's amazing, this journey. It's
like, I think it's because of, I looked at what happened to me and I looked at what happened to my son and I said, I'm not going to let this happen again. Now, my lawyers at the time gave me an option with, oh, you can sue the local authority for negligence here. I go, I could do, and I could get some money out of them, but what good is that? What's better is if I do something else and get them to change their policies and their behaviours and the way. Mm-hmm. Now they come, local authorities, and especially the local authority here where I'm based, again, we train their social workers.
Mm-hmm.
That's a much better turnaround.
Of course it is, yeah. It has a much bigger impact, as you say.
Exactly.
It impacts the greater, wider society rather than just you as an individual.
Exactly. Exactly.
It takes a special person, though, to think like that and to make that call and to, because, you know, you talk about the trauma and I understand the trauma. I know what it feels like when every knock at the door, every call from the social worker or whatever makes you feel like you're physically going to be sick or faint or something. I get that. But it's just the trauma that you experience to actually then be able to work with that and function. Go beyond your own personal trauma, but effectively to be slightly re-traumatized by other people's stories and everything else, is it takes some real kind of courage and guts to be able to do that. And it takes a certain kind of person. Where do you get your strength?
My son. What I went through was nothing compared to what he went through. And he's now, he's just turned 15. And so I'm going through proper, you know, teenage moody swings at the moment.
I'm with you. I've got 16 and a 14.
There you go then. But when I look at him, you know, I go, well, you know, you got through what you got through. I can do this. I can. And then the telephone line here, calls that come through on the helpline, I talk to the dads, I hear their stories. It motivates you to go, do you know what? We have got to do something. Sitting here doing nothing is no longer an option. You know, we are the change that change has been waiting for. We've got to do something. There are people, young people, children, parents suffering because we're not concentrating or putting our minds together to do a better job. There's a really good saying, you know, but Albert Camus, the philosopher, once said, you know, we live in a world where children are regularly tortured. And you know, we live in a world where there's probably nothing we can do about that. But we can reduce those numbers. And if you don't help me, then who in the world will? Mm. And that's my rallying call to people. It's like, we've got to just do it. We can't stand still anymore. It's time for a change. And it will change. And Dads Unlimited has made some significant changes through the work that we've done and the relationships with certain stakeholders that we have got. But there's a long way to go, but we should never think, oh, this is too hard. It's not that hard. You know, great people like yourself, Kate, and others that I've met, we just need to put our heads together and just get on with it and do it, because you've hit the nail on the head. If we get this wrong, then all we're doing is growing up new men and women who will not know how to navigate out of conflict and will not know what healthy relationships look like. All they will know is trauma. So we've got to do it for them. And that's the reason we've got to just work really hard at this. We've all got our experiences. We've all got our traumas. We've all got baggage. As someone once said to me, you've got to take this tragedy and make it mean something.
Yeah. Well, that's you know, the reason behind amicable, just like you, I just got to the point where I just thought there's no way this should be the norm. There's no way this should be the system and how it works. We have to do something about it, and you have to try and change what you can.
Yeah, exactly. And you're right, what you said earlier around, you know, there are some great solicitors and there are some not so great solicitors. It's great and good everywhere. But we've got to start teaching people that you can contribute to lowering the heat in these dynamics. And one of those aspects is you've got to put your fees down. You know, we do all the C100 applications, the C70, we do all of that, position statements, the whole lot, do for free. We don't charge a penny for anything.
Mm-hmm.
We get clients who come through and show us fee notes from solicitors who charged £3,000 to fill out the C100 form.
Yeah.
I mean,
we have that with divorce as well. The same thing, people charging over £2,000 to fill out an application that you can do for yourself on the government website. Oh,
it's exactly. To me, it's unethical. Mm. It's scandalous. And it is exploiting vulnerable adults for financial gain. And I've got no problem saying that to anyone because that's what it is. We just got to say it for what it is. And some of these people are, and they don't know it, they are contributing to the deterioration in parents' mental health because of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's not on.
I agree. There are lots of things wrong with the system and there are lots of things that need to change. What are the key things from your perspective that you feel you're influencing at the moment? What are the big changes you're making?
So we're really lucky. So in Kent, where we are at the moment, Sir Andrew McFarlane put out a sort of a rallying call about developing alliances across the country. So this is about bringing the great and the good of organisations, such as charitable sector, statutory authorities, lawyers, barristers, to come together to look at your area and find out what things you can do to make a change and make a difference. We've set up, we were at the forefront of setting up the Kent Alliance. I've been asked to help set up other alliances around Sussex, but West Midlands, Surrey, et cetera, et cetera. So that's a huge influence we are already having on the sector. I sit on the Nuffield Family Justice Observatory's Stakeholder Advisory Council. I'm fortunate enough that I sit on a couple of APPGs as well. So we're having some real impact and we're being listened to. We have a great relationship with the Senior Board of CAFCAS as well. But we've started, and I did a presentation to Cambridge University a couple of weeks ago to the Family Law Bar Association, and Sir Andrew was there as well. And some of the things we're thinking about here in Kent, and these aren't officially read yet, but we are discussing. The system, if you look at the family court system, and I'm quite a simple man, I look at it as like a central heating system. It's just plumbing, isn't it? It's water coming in, water swishing around, water going out. We've got too many people, too much water coming in, too many people sitting in the system, and when they leave, they come back again. Why is that? Because we've got the wrong valves. Look at this logically. We have got the least experienced judicial decision makers at the beginning of the system. Now, there's no disrespect to them, but they're letting everything in.
Yeah, yeah.
Everything is just going to from first hearing dispute resolution appointment to a dispute resolution appointment. So first hearing to second hearing. And if you've got the least experience at the front, of course you're going to have that because there's going to be more risk aversion. Why don't we put the most experienced judicial decision maker at the beginning at the FEDRA to say, parents, you don't need to be here for this non-communicative issue.
Mm.
Court should be a last resort. And it should be number one for child protection, number two for serious safeguarding issues, domestic abuse, et cetera, et cetera. It shouldn't be where two parents can't get on.
I don't even think those people should be anywhere near the court. I think that whole system should start outside the court because if the minute you're in that court system, it eats you up.
So here's the thing. I agree with you. And so we've got three pathways going on in the alliance and what we're trying to roll out nationally. One is getting the most experienced institutional decision maker at the front. Then much more work on early intervention models, work with schools, primary schools, secondary schools, social workers, la, 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 la. Then hopefully reduce that amount that come to the front door. As soon as they get to the front door of the court, start pushing them back away into services that provide mediation towards consent orders.
Yeah.
Then once you're in, you'll have less people in and you'll have the right cases in. And then once they're out, have a post-court intervention officer to make sure that once a child arrangement order is given, that there's somebody working
enforced.
With the family to make sure it's enforced, but make sure it's bedding down.
Yeah.
So these are all the other things that we are thinking about as well. But these are just ideas at the moment. But it's really important we start focusing on all these different areas because if we don't, the family law system is going to crack. I mean, it's cracking now, it's creaking now, but it should kind of fall flat on its face. So we've got to make some very important decisions around how we do that. So that's the kind of level of influence, you know, this small little charity's had in 6 years, that we are having those top table discussions around, let's change the system, because we've got to improve the outcomes for young people, children and parents going through the system. And we've also got to look after the judges, the lawyers, the social workers, CAFCAS officers, who are probably also burning out.
Yeah, COVID well, they're inundated. Over 280,000 children every year end up in this system.
It's just
too many kids. It's too many lives spoiled, and it's too many people going on, as you say, to repeat the pattern. So
we've also got, and your point is also well made, the reason people go to court is they want a piece of paper to waive.
Yes.
Okay. Now, anything done informally is never going to give that parent the authority of when things go wrong. So actually, services like yours, which are pushing through consent orders, is brilliant. That's what we've got to be looking at. In initiatives that give parents the thing they want, this piece of paper, but to get it in the least adversarial way possible.
Yeah, exactly.
That's the way to do it. It's like this, I get a bit tired of these discussions around, we've got to stop people going to court. No, we don't. We don't stop people going to court. We've got to stop the wrong people going to court.
I'm just conscious of time now, and it's a very fascinating story. But if there are dads listening to this who have experienced even some bits, parts, or recognize some of what you're saying, what would you say to them, you know, having had your experience, having been able to set up this amazing charity? What are your tips? Makes it sound really trivial, but what's your advice for somebody if they're in a situation that they, like you said, they've just got a gut instinct that something is wrong and they need to change it? Where do they go? What do they do?
First and foremost, I would say keep a journal, keep a diary, write down everything. And when I mean everything, dates, times, a whole lot, because trust me, your memory will fade. So make sure you're holding a diary. Number two, we do this in a mentoring service. We teach these dads certain ways of thinking. One of them is success is determined by how far you're willing to travel in terms of fairness and compromise. Truth of the matter is you are not going to get everything you want. You're not.
Yeah.
But you might get enough of it. And it's about being reasonable. So, you know, we say there's no winners here. Everyone loses. But the degree to which you lose is in your hands. Yeah. Never weaponize your children. Remember that nothing is permanent. Things will change. And here's the important bits. Your children are going to suffer. Fact. But again, the degree to which they suffer is in both of your hands. So remember that. And don't project your decision making as having to be automatically accepted by your kids as well. And the breakdown of any relationship, marriage, whatever you want to call it, is always going to be a tragedy. But seen through the eyes of your child, it is a phenomenal that tragedy. It's the difference between what was and what will never be again for them. Mm. And if you put yourself in their shoes and think about how much it hurts, not only you, but them, hopefully that will nudge you into trying to be as cooperative and as reasonable as possible. Mm. And then the last one is, keep going. To those dads, the last thing I'd say is, if you still can't, if you've got no one to reach out to, call our helpline. We're here to listen.
Brilliant. And Naz, we'll put the details of the helpline in the episode blurb so people can contact you if they need to. But that was just such an interesting and amazing story. And thank you so much for sharing it. I really appreciate, you know, how difficult it is to share those personal stories. So I wanted to say properly thank you. And we will put trigger warnings on as well for the things that you've talked about, so that people can be prepared if they want to have a listen, that it's a, you know, it's quite an in-depth episode. But it's amazing what you've done. Where can people find out more about you?
On our website, Dads Unlimited, dadsunltd.org.uk. All the information is on there. We're all, apparently, we're on social media platforms, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and all the usual haunts that people go to nowadays. And then, of course, is our helpline number, 01233 680 150.
Brilliant. Thank you very much for that. And of course, you can find me on Twitter. I'm at @Kate_Daly. And hear about new podcast episodes by following at @divorce_podcast. You can also find more of our podcasts and subscribe for updates by visiting thedivorcepodcast.com. Nav, thank you very much indeed for joining us. And thank you, everyone, for listening.